This is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll share some important facts about multiple myeloma. Then Dr. Denise Dorsey joins us to talk about trauma after a hurricane. And the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy will host their fifth annual Impact Awards here in New Orleans. We'll talk about the recipients and more. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. Stay with us. September is Blood Cancer Awareness Month, but many don't know about the increased prevalence of multiple myeloma, a deadly blood cancer among African Americans. Kimberly Alexander is the widow of former NFL player and myeloma patient Elijah Alexander, and she joins me now. Kimberly, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You were recently in New Orleans to raise awareness about this deadly blood cancer. Give us some quick facts about multiple myeloma.
Well, multiple myeloma is a cancer of the bone marrow. It's also the second largest blood cancer out there. There's a lot of work that needs to be done as far as raising awareness and hopefully finding a cure. There is no known cause of myeloma, and currently it tends to affect African Americans, primarily African American males, more than anyone. And so that was one of the reasons why I became so active in raising awareness about myeloma, because even when my husband was diagnosed with it, we were just completely caught off guard by it.
Mm-hmm. Now, your husband, Elijah Alexander, was diagnosed in 2005. What symptoms were recognized before his diagnosis?
You know what? That was the funny thing about it. Elijah had been in the NFL for 9 years. He'd been relatively healthy, and he retired from football and started complaining about pain in his feet. And so he'd gone to a few doctors in our area trying to get someone to figure out, you know, what the problem was. And they kept telling him, well, you've played football for years. Of course, your feet are going to hurt. Mm-hmm. And so what he ended up doing was actually taking a trip out of the country. He was going to Costa Rica to play golf. And during that flight, he became ill. They had a doctor come into his hotel room to check in on him. And it was that doctor that ran blood work and told him that he noticed some things that were alarming and that Elijah needed to get back to the States and see his own physician. And so that's what started our life with multiple myeloma. He returned back to the United States. They did some blood work here, and sure enough, he was diagnosed and literally started chemo within the week. It was a very, very, very fast process once we figured out what the problem was.
And what does that treatment process look like?
Well, it was really complicated because by the time Elijah was diagnosed, he was at what's called stage 3B, which is the worst stage. His kidneys were basically going into kidney failure, and so they had to get his kidneys healthy before he could even begin chemo. So he went through a process called plasmapheresis, and then he was able to start chemo. Once he went through chemo for a little while to kind of help stabilize him, he ended up having a stem cell transplant in February of 2006, and that is quite common for myeloma patients. It was basically a way for them to reset his immune system, but after that, it's just a matter of kind of coming up with the right combination of drugs and treatment just to kind of keep the myeloma at bay. Because there is no cure for myeloma, it ends up going in and out of remission, and you just don't really know when that's going to happen.
And how long was your husband's fight?
He almost made it to 5 years. He passed away at 39, just shy of hitting the five-year mark with myeloma.
Now, since your husband's death, you've been raising awareness for multiple myeloma through an initiative called Standing in the Gap. Tell us more about that.
Well, Standing in the Gap is a program that, as you said, it raises awareness, but it also wants to change the disparities that have been noticed between the way African Americans receive treatment and other races. Essentially, African Americans don't get stem cell transplants at the same rates as others, and that's really key to helping extend the life of a myeloma patient. So we're trying to figure out why that's happening and get information out there so that we can make a difference in that regard. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so involved with Blood Cancer Awareness Month and just trying to do whatever I can to help families who find themselves in the same position we were in a few years ago.
What advances have we seen in regards to myeloma?
There have been advances in how to treat the disease and how to help patients live with the disease. There really has been a lot of improvement. Before, it had been 2 years or less, you know, the typical lifespan after diagnosis. And right now, the average has gone up to 5 to 6 years. So that's really a step in a positive direction.
Kimberly, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Imagine experiencing your most traumatic moment twice. That's what many Katrina victims are struggling with after Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. Here to talk more about being re-traumatized by the devastation of a hurricane is Dr. Denise Dorsey. Dr. Dorsey, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. It's quite a privilege.
Thanks for coming on. So before we get into the conversation, tell us about the work you guys do at the New Orleans Birmingham Psychoanalytic Center.
The Psychoanalytic Center is a nonprofit organization that has several functions. One of them is to train psychoanalysis to mental health professionals in the community and also in psychotherapy. It's also a organization that reaches out to the community and helps clinicians who want to understand more about the psychoanalytic perspective.
Okay. Now, why this partnership between New Orleans and Birmingham?
Well, it's actually the result of Katrina. Certainly, we had several members that were in Birmingham, but we hadn't changed our name because they were involved with us. Mm-hmm. However, after Katrina, a number of our key people that were training analysts at the time relocated permanently to Birmingham, making that a cluster of concentration where we had equally as many founding father people in both locations. And so in many respects, I think we changed our name as a symbolic way to help them solidify their identity, which is actually one of those key features that I think is getting involved with all the people that have relocated. Mm-hmm. And so for us too, this was a way for us to reinforce the notion that their identity had not been totally lost, but evolved and transformed.
Yeah. Many of the clinicians that are associated with the center have gone through the trauma of Katrina. Let's talk about how essential that is in regards to then helping their patients get through that same trauma.
What was happening is that I think all of the clinicians were falling prey to the same issues that we'll talk about that we all as human beings are prone to do. And that is one of the ways of dealing with trauma when there is such obvious practical devastation, and the issues of daily living consume all of our attention in terms of just rebuilding and buying groceries and moving about your day, that the emotional losses of what one has experienced get denied, doubted, dismissed. And so consequently, the therapists were falling prey to some of the same issues. And it was a very unique experience because the therapist had actually, it was a shared trauma experience. We all had been through the same trauma. And so some of the impairment that ordinarily we are there to help our patients deal with, we were suffering from too. Mm-hmm. And so we needed help.
Yeah.
And so what resulted was a wonderful foundation centered in New York called the FAR Fund. It's anonymous donors who support psychoanalytic and psychodynamic projects. And they usually only fund projects in that Northeast corridor, but they blessed us with a 4-year grant, which enabled us to begin devising ways to help ourselves with the emotional task that we needed to go through in order to be able to be fully available for our patients. Mm-hmm.
And what was the best end result, in your opinion, from the FAR Fund?
One of the largest end results was a major event that was hosted here at UNO. We must have had 1,500 attendees.
Wow.
Where a number of people spoke about their experience. And it was a very healing process for us. What was happening is we would go to meetings, but we weren't talking. And this is our community. These
right.
were the people we should be talking to, but we weren't talking about it there either.
Mm-hmm. Now, in regards to this trauma, let's talk about how important that is to talk.
Yes.
In a safe space.
Yes, yes. So if we could just take a couple of minutes and I'll try to walk you through some basics of what trauma is going to do, the result of trauma to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So trauma is always going to, whatever kind of trauma, it's always going to involve loss. And therefore, it requires mourning. We mourn lost people, items, identities, futures.
There's a grieving process.
There is a grieving process whenever trauma is involved, regardless of the nature of the trauma. Now, the problem with this is compounded in these kinds of situations because the emotional losses are paralleled with a devastating external loss. And so there is so much energy and attention demanded to deal with the external losses in order to even accomplish the essentials of daily living that it's as though, and it's a human tendency too, because we don't want to think about painful things. And besides that, there's no time to, because you're swallowed up with all of the things.
Because life continues.
Yeah, life continues, and you have to find some way to earn your living, or recapture a new career, mm-hmm. or rebuild your house, there are multiple factors that, both psychological and practical, that reinforce a human tendency to not want to mourn, which would be integrating, synthesizing, digesting painful experience. So if you can imagine these kinds of catastrophic events are a prime setup to result in a traumatic reaction. A trauma overwhelms one's mind, okay? And your mind forms multiple functions in the course of every day. What happens in trauma is the ability to mentalize is broken. It is broken in everyone, and this has grave impact on people. It has much more of a devastating impact than the loss of objects.
Wow.
Because without that, they can't think. They can't think properly. And so the problem also is that it's unseen, and it's easy for it to remain unacknowledged. Particularly then when you couple it with all the practical necessities of keeping your life going.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this function of the mind to reflect and integrate your life story. Another function is to distinguish between past and present. We do that by synthesizing, integrating, and moving experience to a past memory. Now, that's a major aspect in mourning. So if you think about it, you know, there's major loss that gets integrated and moved to memory and moved to a past experience so that at some point one has distance from it and they remember. And if mourning is successful, it's remembered and it is still felt, but it doesn't have the gut-wrenching kind of presence of the here and now.
Mm-hmm.
And in that regard, it is digested, so to speak. And if you can't digest a horrific experience, then in fact, you can't move it to memory. So this is what the basis of flashbacks is. So in other words, people who have experienced an overwhelming emotional experience and who have, for various reasons, denied the whole emotional loss that is there and focused on the bright side or all the things they do have, it then can close off acknowledgement of all of the painful feelings that are there that need to be digested, and instead they just stay stuck.
But Dr. Dorsey, I have to imagine that looking on that bright side could be quite difficult.
Well, you see it on all the TV interviews. I know it's what's recommended. I think the problem is you can't really do it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
You can't really do it. But then people will start chastising. There's like layer upon layer. They'll start chastising themselves. Like, for instance, they'll say, why am I still depressed? Why is it I have no energy? Why is it I can't think? Why is it I can't sleep? And then if it's much worse symptomatology, why is it I can't get that visual image out of this person that I saw in some terrible shape?
Yeah.
And it intrudes in when I'm doing the dishes, even, you know, just any mundane task, I have this intrusive thought that's gut-wrenching.
Right.
It's not just a memory of that picture. It's the experience, because the emotions, the painful emotions, have never been digested.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's your advice to victims of Katrina that just went through Harvey again?
Well, to gather in their own community on a regular basis. Going overboard in trying to stay connected to those. So let's say the people that relocated, they have developed a network of friends, family, coworkers, neighbors, whatever their community is, church community. But to allow there to be a regular preset meeting time, and it's just to get together and let ourselves talk about what we've been going through. There's obviously some practical advantage just in sharing details of what contractor and who not to use and those kinds of things. But we can talk about it all. Like, there's not anything that we have to exclude here. So if someone's having a rough time with remembering or feeling a painful loss, they have space to talk about it, and it's okay. It's deemed okay by their community.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Denise Dorsey, thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you very much for the privilege. It was very nice.
That was Dr. Denise Dorsey, member of the New Orleans Birmingham Psychoanalytic Center. The National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy will soon host their fifth annual Impact Awards. This ceremony acknowledges groups and activists from across the country who have ramped up their fight against injustice and inequities in our community. Joining me now to talk about the 2017 Impact Awards is NCRP's Vice President and Chief Engagement Officer, Janae Isler. Janae, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. Great name.
Absolutely.
First off, you guys call yourselves the Independent Watchdogs of Philanthropy. Tell us about the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy and the work you've been doing across the country for the last 40 plus years.
Yes, we are absolutely an independent watchdog for philanthropy. And we were founded by a group of social justice nonprofit leaders who were really concerned about the lack of accountability for foundations and other donors in philanthropy. So our mission and our vision is to have a philanthropic sector that really sees itself as being responsive and accountable to all of the people that we seek to serve. So our work is about doing research that shows how effective transparent strategies are, and also the benefit of really investing in grassroots communities, people of color, women, and other marginalized communities. So we produce well-researched data, and then we tell stories through our media and communications. And we have engagement activities so that funders who want to improve their practices can actually implement some of the best practices that we've found over the years. Mm-hmm. And that is why we have Impact Awards, so that we can tell those best practice stories.
Now, you've been doing this work for a while, but the Impact Awards started 5 years ago. How did that begin?
We really recognize that there are more and more funders who want to do well, who want to make sure that their dollars are used effectively and that they're really supporting systemic change. And that really is a shift for the sector from when NCRP was founded over 40 years ago. So to facilitate funders who have that desire, we created the Impact Awards. And this initiative is, it's more than just a reception, although the reception is really fun. It's about telling the stories of funders who are giving grants to social justice groups and strategies, who are very intentional about including marginalized communities in decision-making, and who are demonstrating their own leadership to influence their peers' grant-making and giving.
Who are this year's awardees and how were they chosen?
Well, this year, because it's the fifth anniversary, we actually had more ambitious categories than we've had in the past. And so this year's winners, we really see are the best of the best. So in no particular order, we have the Groundswell Fund for the Smashing Silos Award. And this award is for a funder who looks at communities not for one identity, like a race or economic status or gender, but really is funding groups who bridge those divides and work across communities to affect systemic change for everyone. The next recipient is the Solutions Project, which has some very famous benefactors like Mark Ruffalo. But this organization received the award for Get Up, Stand Up, and this is for rapid response. And rapid response funding is very critical in these times when we have natural disasters and political disasters happening all around us. So the Solutions Project has been instrumental in funding Native American communities and Standing Rock and other groups. The third is the Meyer Memorial Trust in Oregon for the Changing Course Award. And this award is for a funder who really intentionally sought feedback from their grantees and others in their communities and did a good job of incorporating that feedback. And Meyer Memorial Trust has done that well. Mm-hmm. And last but not least, we have Foundation for Louisiana, who will be receiving the Mover and Shaker Award for organizing their peers.
And I want to point out, Janae, that these grant makers are from across the country.
Yes.
Now, let's focus on the home state. Foundation for Louisiana is being awarded, as you said, the Mover and Shaker Award. What stood out about this foundation and their work in comparison to the mission and work of NCRP?
One of the criteria that we look at for the Impact Awards, we've done this for the last 5 years, and we do this throughout our work, is for foundation leaders, particularly the executives and boards, to use their leadership to influence their peers. There's very little accountability that occurs naturally for foundations. So when a foundation executive like Bozell Daniels really steps out and convenes his peers, educates them about local issues, and encourages them to take action on those issues, that's a very important part of what it means to be a philanthropist. And Foundation for Louisiana has done that extremely well, not only around criminal justice, but also about other systemic issues in the state of Louisiana, and we wanted to award them for that.
Great. What can folks expect at the Impact Awards happening Monday night?
People can expect a party. This is a celebration of people who are doing well, and again, it's the best of the best. So there will be music and food and drink. There will be a room of about 200 to 300 people who work at foundations and nonprofits from across the country who will be there for a larger conference taking place. And we're just going to tell the stories of the folks who won, give out a couple of awards, and allow people to socialize and celebrate and network together.
Janae, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Janae Isler, Vice President and Chief Engagement Officer for the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy. And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Would you like to suggest a guest or topic? Send an email to Janae at WWNO.org. That's J-A-N-A-E at WWNO.org. Visit our website to check out previous shows and be sure to catch us next week right here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans
and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. Thanks for joining us.